Hola, mi amigo.
Are you talking to me? Are you talking to
Sí.
me?
Sí. ¿Cuándo?
¿Qué pasa? Are you reading Mexican comics? Is that what you're leading us into?
No, I'm just still
Spanish comics?
I'm still in the Spanish mode from my vacation.
Ah, did you learn to speak more better?
No, it brought a few words back. I had been studying earlier last year and I didn't really keep up with it, but it did bring some of it back, and since I've been back, it kind of remotivated me to start studying
Oh,
again.
nice.
Yes. But I basically just used my 20 words or so.
It was good enough to get you by.
Yeah, most people speak English and they'd only speak Spanish
You need
if you
the
spoke Spanish to them.
you need to say bathroom, food, and
Yeah.
water, I guess. And
Like
then
if you
transportation, be able to say, key things so you can get around, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that spoke English and so they would usually respond in kind. If you said thank you, they would say you're welcome. If you said gracias, they would say mucho gusto.
Yeah. So
So,
we've been away for a while.
yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's
It's been
a month
like
and a
right
half.
before Christmas. We took a Christmas break and you went to Costa Rica.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. Longtime listeners know that I got married back in September, but we decided to wait on our honeymoon until January, partially because we had used up a lot of vacation time already last year, and also just because of where we live, it was really nice to get a break from the winter weather. So, yeah, I'm happy to say we had an awesome time. We had a really excellent time. Both of us have had a tough time coming back to reality afterwards. It was a little bit depressing to come back to the weather around here, but we did time it well. It turned out to be a really, really cold, miserable week here while we were gone.
Yeah.
So that worked out well. So that was part of the reason that we didn't come back. The show didn't come back from the holidays as soon, because we were gone just after the New Year's.
Part was my fault, 'cause when you did come back, I was gone.
Yeah, that delayed it another week, but
Yeah.
and then the other thing, we probably would have gotten one more episode in towards the end of last year before we went on hiatus, but this is something I wanted to share here. Mike, you already know this, but
Yeah.
Kara and I said goodbye to our dog Luna in the middle of December, December 17th, and haven't really, besides family and people at work, because I had to take some days off, and you and Barb, I haven't really said too much. But I've talked about her a lot on the show. We've talked about our dogs over the years that we've been doing the show now, and I know she would even make appearances early on the show, back when I record upstairs and the early days of the show, she was still getting up and down the stairs on her own pretty easily. So she'd show up in the background sometimes. So
Yeah, you'd see the door open. You
yeah,
wouldn't
the door
see
would
it,
pop
but
open.
you'd hear it pop open.
Yeah, and she'd be standing there wondering why the door was closed. But so it's been a little over a month now.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, man.
Yeah, I
That's
know.
not a fun thing to go through.
It was tough. It was really devastating, especially for my wife. She adopted Luna when Luna was 6 months old, and she lived to be just a couple of months short of her 16th birthday. So, I mean, we do have the peace that she lived a long life, and we do have peace of mind about it being the right time. There was a couple of weeks of of sort of wondering, and the weekend prior to saying goodbye was really agonizing because she was, the signs weren't completely there yet, and then she sort of took a turn for the better, and actually the day before she ended up we ended up saying goodbye. I was actually pretty optimistic that she was going to be around for a couple months and still have some quality of life, but then things really took a really bad turn. But we were fortunate to have a really awesome vet, and we were there with her until the end. So it's really hard. It's still hard. We still miss her a lot, but we have started to kind of transition into more of the stage of grief where you're there's more happy and you're focused a little more on the happy memories.
You're remembering the happy times, and yeah, you miss them, but you're able to move on.
Yeah. So things have we were both towards the end of the year took really put a sort of a damper on the holidays, and we were both kind of in a depression for a little while towards the end of the year, and it was good timing for our honeymoon to sort of have a break to get
To
away.
get away from the house too.
Yeah, to get away from the house.
Yeah.
Because as you know, that's where a
Ev
lot of the
they're
memories are.
yeah, they're more than you are.
Yeah. So some of that came back when we did come back from the honeymoon and got back to our house and everything, but
It's the little things, it's the habitual things that hurt me the most.
yeah.
Like I used to get up in the middle of the night and let the dog out. And then you're not doing it anymore. And you're like,
Right.
what the? Your body doesn't know what to do. And
Yeah.
then you just get real depressed. And it's just little things, you know?
Yeah, it throws
It's
off your
them
routine.
jumping on the couch or something. And you're sitting there and you're like, that's not happening anymore. So it's a sad thing.
Yeah, the hardest for me was coming home because I was always the first one to get home. And not having her greet me, that was always for the last couple of years, for me was really an uplifter because, you know, I have a long commute and I'm usually pretty, that's probably the point in which the day that's the worst point of the day. So it was always really uplifting to be greeted by her.
Yeah, there's nothing like a good greeting, because you come home from a stressful day at work and your dog is there, except for Harley. She doesn't give a shit. She sometimes we come home sometimes and she's asleep. I don't think she can hear worth a damn.
Yeah, Luna definitely towards the end of her hearing got bad, so sometimes it would take her a minute to realize, but
Yeah,
still, I mean,
Scooter went deaf.
yeah.
He had di really bad diabetes, but it's weird too, because it's hard to know when, because it there are those days where they start doing their normal behaviors, you know? They eat right, they follow you around like they normally follow you around, and then it's like a crash, and it's like, what the hell's going on? And yeah, it's heartbreaking. I'm sorry.
I mean,
It doesn't get easier with each animal either, unfortunately.
no, but and I just try to, I mean, lately I've been able to focus on the positive a little bit more that I just really feel blessed that when I met my wife, you know, not only was my life so much better to have her in it, but you know, on top of it, I'm really grateful that, you know, Luna, her life was long enough that I got to be a part of it, and it really made a difference in me as a person to care for her, you know, because I didn't really, I've only growing up, my family had cats, so she was really my first dog, and it made me a better person to care for her, and you know, and I just,
And she cared for you. It was both ways.
yeah, it meant a lot to me the way that she accepted me, and for the longest time it was just her and her mom, you know, and the way that she accepted me into her pack, basically. But I just been trying to support my wife and everything, because I feel like everything I'm experiencing, I try to think of it, it's five times as strong for her, you know, because like I said, Kara had Luna for over 15 and a half years. And I just can't, like, the experiences that I've had of trying to adjust to the new routines and stuff. It's just, I can't even imagine after I think about how different my life was 15 and a half years ago. And it really drives home for me how long ago that was. And so for her, the changes in the routines of, you know, not having a dog to walk and everything like that, it's been a really big adjustment for her, you know.
Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, we have a lot of wonderful memories, and ultimately I think that
she lived a good life too.
She did. I mean, my wife took such good care of her.
She had good parents.
Yeah. So honestly, I mean, having a dog for a long life like that, I mean, we're blessed, and it's as hard as it is to say goodbye. I mean, it's just totally worth it for all the good, you know, to have that relationship. So it's been tough, but like I said, we're coming to a point of cherishing all the really great memories that we have, now that it's been a little while. But so it was a tough end of the year, but ultimately, like, 2014 was a really great year. You know, just a lot of changes for my family, and my parents retired, and I got married, and my sister had a daughter, so I have a new niece. So it was an eventful year. It ended kind of on a tough note, but all in all, I have to say my life is the best it's ever been. So that's where I've been. That's what's been going on, and
we're back.
We're back, and as far as I know, we should be on schedule for a while. So
yes,
sharing the love of some old but not forgotten entertainment.
That's right.
Well,
do you want to jump into the movie you chose?
Sure. Yeah.
Because I guess, how many times have you seen this movie?
It has been a while since I've seen it. I've seen it probably not a ton of times, maybe like four or five times or something.
That's a lot. See, this is my first time.
Yeah.
Absolute first time. And
it's not a movie you want to watch every day, really.
No, it's not. But
yeah,
there's a lot there. There's a lot of substance, and I think the movie's pretty deep. It's got, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's got aspects of, like, vigilante. It's got aspects of somebody that's not – that doesn't understand, like, social structure too well. And I don't know if he ever had it, you know, because you never get a sense of that.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Even before he, you know, went off to war – you don't know if he had something, if he had like antisocial behavior before, but it's like a weird antisocial, because he still has the confidence to go up to people. Do you know what I mean? It's not like usually when you're totally antisocial, you try to be an introvert and try to avoid human contact. Well, he definitely doesn't. And this movie's deeper from a historical perspective. Because this Travis Bickle was, you know, based on Arthur Brimmer's diary, and he actually shot a Democratic candidate, George Wallace, and paralyzed him from the waist down. And this diary was kind of like what Taxi Driver was based on. And then later on, it's got a weird historical aspect to it, because the guy who shot Ronald Reagan had a fascination with Jodie Foster, kind of like the way Taxi Driver or Bickle had a fascination with, what was her name? Sybil Shepherd, you know,
right.
Betsy.
Yeah,
it was the same sort of relationship. So he thought by shooting Ronald Reagan, he would be in the favor of Jodie Foster in his mind. And we almost saw this scene happen in Taxi Driver, because there was a scene, because this guy's running for president. Mm-hmm. And he has a couple run-ins with Secret Service who never seem to be able to catch him. But it really, thank you for picking this movie, because, man, I just – not only was it great to see – there's some good – like Robert De Niro, I've never seen him this young. He's like awesome in this. And then Jodie Foster still looks like she came out of Freaky Friday in a Disney movie.
Well, she actually was only 14 years old.
Yeah, so
in
she's
this movie. Yeah,
she was a young prostitute in this movie, and then Harvey Keitel was her pimp. Sybil Shepherd was the girl working for the candidate that was running for president. Her name was Betsy, and Travis loved, like, he was just infatuated with her. Albert Brooks was kind of like the guy that also worked with Sybil Shepherd. But there was just, like, Peter Boyle was in there, too.
Yeah, he was the other one I had down to mention. He plays a fellow taxi, like a more experienced taxi driver.
Yeah, he's very experienced, because even Travis turns to him, like, for mentorship.
Yeah.
But yeah, he'd always, like, be in the restaurant talk, and he was kind of like the lead guy. Everybody would just listen to the wizard, you know? And then the other interesting character was Martin Scorsese himself.
Yeah.
Which I thought was the turning point in the movie, where Travis started to think differently. I thought that scene where he drove Martin Scorsese to see his wife in a silhouette in the window having sex with another man, and him talking about guns, I think that's where the trigger just... He almost seemed scared listening to it, the way he was acting, but then he was absorbing it. Like he was like, man, something just triggered in his mind.
Right. Yeah, that's an insightful comment, because I a lot of critical analysis and stuff that I've looked at about the movie also talk about that as being the turning point of the movie, because you kind of, as you said, I mean, Travis has clearly from the beginning of the movie already has some social problems and maybe some mental illness, and but there's a real difference in him before that point in the movie and him after that point in the movie. And before that, you feel like he's more on the precipice of... He certainly has some antisocial opinions and other undesirable traits, but there's a sense from him that you think maybe he's trying to make an effort. He still wants to try to fit into society.
That's true, but he does look at the bulk of society as, where at least where he drives his taxi, as detriments to society.
Right.
Like these people are awful. And I'm in a situation where I do this, but I'm in a bad situation, and we should just clean the city. The city needs to be cleansed because it's filthy. It's disgusting. And he has that attitude. He even goes to the guy that's running for president, Senator Charles Palatine, and he says, that was a weird coincidence. That was a weird coincidence that I just thought, man, that's weird. Is one time the senator gets inside of his taxi cab instead of the limo that he usually goes in.
Yeah.
And that's where he actually has a conversation with Travis Bickle.
Right.
And the senator actually makes a good comment, and this is where I was like, why does he want to kill the senator? Because the senator seemed like somebody that like he was listening to Travis. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He listened to him. Not only did he listen to him, as he left, he shaked his hand, where he didn't have to do that. You know, he could have just left.
Right.
But he stopped there and he listened to him and he's like, what do you think we need to do to fix this? And that's where he went off on that tirade and said, we just need to burn it. We need to destroy it all and build it back up.
Yeah, I think one of the last things he says is flush it down the fucking toilet.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's an interesting scene because you get the sense that the senator is just kind of taking the opportunity to hear from the common person, and then Travis goes a little farther than he's comfortable with. You know, he still puts up appearances. He doesn't want to risk negative publicity or anything like that, but you do, so it, the camera does linger on his face as he's walking away from the cab, and he sort of looks at one of his guards or whatever and shakes his head. And you get, I at least kind of get the impression that he gets a little bit of, he gets a weird vibe and thinks Travis is a little nuts, you know?
Yeah.
But a couple other, you already mentioned Martin Scorsese. He's the director, of course, and this is one of the movies he made his name on early on. Same thing with Robert De Niro. I mean, as you said, he's younger than, well, obviously it's the film came out in 1976, so obviously he's a lot younger than he is today. but he was 33 at the time. Travis Bickle, the character he plays, is supposed to be 26, so it's pretty close. Just like I mentioned, Jodie Foster, the prostitute, she's only 12 and a half in the movie, and Jodie Foster herself is only 14 at the time. So, Cybill Shepherd was only 26.
Yeah.
Paul Schrader was the writer. And he also, another, I don't know if you've seen Raging Bull, but that's another one I would recommend. That is a De Niro Scorsese film. He read that at all. He wrote that also. In the score, I don't know what you thought about the music, but I feel like the music plays a big part in the film.
You know what? I didn't notice it too much. I don't know why my focus was on more what was happening, but well, I didn't notice the background sound. Maybe if I watched it again, I'd be listening to it more, but I was so engrossed with what was happening on the film itself that I didn't capture a lot of the background music or anything.
Right. Well, and it's like, it's different watching a movie for the fourth or fifth time than the first time, obviously. The score is by Bernard Herrmann, and was a really famous composer for Citizen Kane, and he worked with Hitchcock a lot. That's really his main thing that he's known for, is working with Hitchcock. He did the score for Psycho, Vertigo, and just a lot of Hitchcock movies. Well, this was one of his last compositions, actually, one of the last movies he did. If you watch the credits all the way to the end, there's a tribute to him. He died right before the film came out, basically, or a few months before the film came out. But it's really moody and methodical. I feel it. There's always the percussion is always a real just like tapping beat that, and then it's pretty simple in that there's just that you have that percussion, and then you have these long drawn out saxophone notes.
Right, because a lot of times he's just driving in the taxi.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting enough, he's not a very social taxi driver, you know, like how's the weather or anything. He kind of just hits the button and then drives them. He doesn't say much unless he's reacting to something.
Right.
And the budget was $1.3 million. And it made $28 million at the time.
Yeah. I'm glad you picked up on the whole veteran angle, because, you know, you quoted at the beginning, this is the source of the, I think a lot of people have heard the quote, "Are you talking to me?" That monologue that he gives, even if they haven't seen this movie. And there's a lot of, I mean, it's a violent movie, like a lot of Scorsese movies. Scorsese, a lot of his films deal with masculinity, too. You know, they deal with men and the violence that men do and their motivations. And I think this movie and other movies of his, like Goodfellas and things, where people can watch on a superficial level and just respond to the violence and the machismo, and just especially guys can watch it and just enjoy that aspect of it and not pick up on the critique of that stuff. And I think that's one of the things about Taxi Driver, is it makes you think, I feel, and it makes you look at Travis and maybe some of the things that you might identify with him about, and it puts it in your face and makes you question, is this really a person I want to identify with, you know?
Yeah.
But also, like you said, I mean, it explores a lot
He's
of.
also got chronic insomnia.
Right.
So the fact that he can't sleep could play a part in his mental well-being as well. Because
Definitely.
he literally can't sleep at all. Like he basically come off his job in the late early mornings and go watch porn to try to he'd sit down, order some popcorn, and he tried to be social. There was even when he was at the porn theater, he asked the girl, and he wasn't asking her to be vile or anything. He was just like, "What's your name?" You know, and she didn't want to give him his name. And then "You want me to call the bouncer to kick you out?" And he's like, "No. I'll just take some juji fruits and some popcorn and go watch my porn." But he has an interesting thing in there because he finally gets the courage, because he's been watching her, he almost in a creepy way. Like Sybil Shepherd is
Oh,
like,
definitely.
she if I had saw this guy watching me and then he approached me, I'd be terrified. Personally, I really would. But you know, he's like watching her, and she even has Albert Brooks go out there and chase him away one day. But I don't think she really gets a really good look. She just knows that he's watch, and one day he just walks in, and he's like, "I think you're the most beautiful thing on the planet, and I'd like to take you on a date," essentially. And they talk a little bit, but he goes through saying, "I'd like to volunteer to help the candidate." And she said, "Well, how would you like to help? You know, this job is like almost like a full day's worth of work, and we have to work nights as well." And he goes, "I can't. I drive a taxi at night. I won't be able to do that." But he gets the confidence, and he says, "Okay, we'll go out for a piece of pie." And you know, she gets her fruit salad, and they start talking. And I think at that point she finds out that he's fascinating. He's like a fascinating human being, and I do want to go on a second date with him. And he convinces her to go to the movies, and you're like, "Oh, well, that's a cool thing. You know, he's going to take her to the movies." But what does he do? He pulls a Guy Gardner. What did a Guy Gardner do with ice? He took her to a porn movie. This is exactly what Travis Bickle did. And I bet you anything that when they wrote that Guy Gardner ice, that they had watched Taxi Driver. I would bet you anything
I'd be surprised if they didn't get the idea from
if
that.
they didn't, because he took her to a porn and it scared the hell out of her. But he got her into the theater, which is amazing. She didn't like stop at the beginning of the theater. They got their tickets and went in. And he's like, "Well, there's other couples in here, and you know, I come here all the time." And he didn't think anything was wrong. And then he scared her even worse because she ran out like, "This isn't me." But he started to get a little violent. And what I mean by that is he didn't hit her or anything, but he would like grab her arm like really aggressively and like, "Don't go away yet. You know, we're not done," kind of thing. But it's still a threatening motion to her. And the fact I actually thought it was amazing that she talked to him at least one more time on the phone. You know what I mean? And said, "You know, this ain't gonna work, blah blah blah. I sent you flowers. The flowers didn't get there for whatever reason. They got sent back." But yeah, that whole exchange was really interesting. He had no social. He what he did by doing that, he had no ill will. He didn't know better. He didn't take her to the porn because he wanted to fuck her, like immediately. And you'll notice this. Because he has a chance to screw Jodie Foster, he actually has to pay to see her essentially.
Right.
And what he wants to do is the prince, you know, the prince charming thing, except
Right.
not in a relationship. He knows she's a kid. And
Yeah.
he's like, "What are you doing? Do you see what you're doing? You're like 12 years old and you have this guy, this pimp treating you like shit." Because there's a scene in the taxi cab where he sees Harvey Keitel kind of like slapping her around. And he even keeps in his hand that crumpled $20 bill. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it shows up throughout the movie.
Yeah, he doesn't spend it. He keeps it back and he throws it at the guy when the guy that's guarding the room for him to see Jodie Foster.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean, backing up just a little bit. I think that's one of the moments that you sort of see. You know, Travis is pinning a lot of his hopes of sort of being a real person and fitting on Betsy, you know, and I, when she rejects him, he has a hard time handling it. And as you said, you start to see some of his frustration. He doesn't really want to hurt her, but he has a really hard time accepting that she's going to reject him now that she's given him the time of day. And I think, you know, he is a little bit insightful in the fact that I think she really is kind of bored by her life and her day to day, and she is initially excited by what he has to offer as a intriguing individual. I mean, she seems like she's a educated person. You know, she quotes a Kris Kristofferson song to him, and then he goes out and buys the album that the song's on and gives it to her as a present before he takes her to the porn theater. But the song that she quotes, she calls him, it goes, he's a prophet and a pusher, partly truth, partly fiction, a walking contradiction. And he really takes he just picks up on the pusher part and really takes exception to that. I'm not no drug dealer, you know.
Yeah.
But she says, no, I'm really more talking about the walking contradiction part. And it's really true to him because, you know, here he's this person that is disgusted by filth of the city, and he's talking about, you know, the scum on the streets and calling them animals and stuff. And then on the other hand, you know, he's totally complicit in that by spending all his time in porno theaters, you know. And it's really contradictory. You know, and I think she has a picture of what he's like, and then that's completely shattered, but she's so shocked by the fact that he's brought her to a porn theater. It's just so totally out of left field. You know, she's just, you gotta be kidding. And he looks at her like, what's the problem? And she says, this is a dirty movie.
Right.
You know, and it's just, she's so shocked that she gets all the way into the theater. But, and I think it's actually one of those, it's like a European film that's disguised as an educational film. Like there's stuff about like biology and stuff that you see on the screen. And then you hear the noises of actual sex and stuff. And she gets out of there pretty quick, you know?
Yeah.
One of the first encounters that he has is with Iris, with Jodie Foster's character. She said she gets in the car and seems to want to get out of there. And this is an event that he keeps referring to. And then Harvey Keitel, her pimp, comes, pulls her out, and drops that 20 on the seat. And you see it a couple times throughout the film. He's going to give some money to one of the other cab drivers, and you see the 20 in his hand. And he pulls that aside and keeps it, and keeps holding on to it. I think like a lot of people that are like Travis, I think he idealizes innocence, you know, and
he's very observant. Like, you know, some people have a gift, like there's some like detectives and stuff that could just like look at patterns and like characterize who that person is. Mm-hmm. And I think he has that ability.
Yeah.
And that's even what attracted Cybill Shepherd to Travis, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's, this movie's deep on so many levels, and it is disturbing because it's not only this. It's like the second movie I saw this week with PTSD because I saw The American Sniper, so it's like it is a deep thing to deal with that because war, you're on the edge of your seat for your life at all times.
Yeah, and
Even if you're
that's
not knocking down walls, you're even if you're like putting up a comm line, you can get killed. And that's got to do some damage to the way you think when you come back and everything appears normal, you know? It's not. It'll change your life.
And that's definitely one of the things that this film doesn't, it doesn't beat your head over with the fact that it's about a veteran. You know, it's talked about in the beginning of the film when they introduce the character. We know that he's a Vietnam vet, that he served in the Marines, and that he was, at least
Honorable
according to him,
discharge, yeah.
honorable discharge. Yeah, that he talks about it with the guy who initially gives him the taxi driver job. And it's definitely, you know, a character study of a young man, on a young Vietnam veteran trying to fit back into society and his inability to do that. And I think maybe on top of post-traumatic stress disorder, he has some other mental illnesses. But yeah, I mean that's it doesn't.
But he's also got insomnia and he's not taking anything for it. So his body is almost like going almost 24 hours. I'm sure he does get some sleep, like because
Yeah,
you're
but
he would die. You know what I mean?
but
Eventually.
not.
But it's not like the what normal sleep is. He'll sleep an hour, 2 hours a night, and then he's like restless the whole night. You know, you see a couple scenes where he just toss and turns the whole night. You know, just thinking. And
And he looks worse throughout the movie. You can tell he's not. I mean, he's like when he shows up, he shows up again to the campaign office when Betsy won't return his calls, and you know, he's in really rough shape. I mean, you look at De Niro's face, and he's sweaty, and like he looked like you did at that con. You know, his eyes are. He's just in rough shape. You could tell this guy is not doing well. He looks like shit. And he just gets worse as the film goes on. You know, and this is right before, like you said, it's the director, Martin Scorsese. The character never has a name, and people just refer to him as the unnamed passenger. But it's a really rough scene. I mean, it's a really rough, this character is like Travis beyond anywhere that he's at this point, but he introduces all these ideas into Travis's head, and
And he sure does. And he's already talked to the wizard and the other guy who says, you know, taxi driving's a dangerous thing because it has they've been mugged and money stolen. They have neighborhoods where people will attack their cab, you know. And one of the taxi cab drivers says, I know contacts that we could hook you up with the gun. You know, hey, Travis, you ever used a gun? Have you thought of using a gun? And then he has the Scorsese scene. And then he talks to the wizard later on about kind of like life and being a taxi driver.
Yeah, he's
And
trying to reach out. He's trying to get some help.
trying to get help. And then he decides to get the guns. And not only does he get one gun, he buys a whole suitcase of guns. You know, he gets the Magnum, he gets holsters for him. He even develops like a Deadshot thing, you know, like or one of those like gambler guns, you know, that gamblers used to use where it'll flip the gun out of your hand. And he starts working out. There's one scene in there that reminded me of Cape Fear because Robert De Niro is in Cape Fear and he's doing the pull-ups on the bar. And you see the same sort of scene, except it's a younger De Niro doing the pull-ups on the bar.
And
And I was like,
he gets pretty tight. Like he gets pretty like De Niro, he's a skinny guy, but he gets pretty
toned.
buff, toned. And I thought it was interesting. I didn't notice this other times I watched it, or I forgot. But when you see him doing push-ups, Like you mentioned, you don't really know what happened to him in the war, but he's got a like a sick scar on his back.
I didn't notice it.
Yeah, I didn't notice it before, but he's got a really major scar on his back, and you don't see it for very long, but I almost kind of thought that it was an indication of like maybe he got hurt in the war. Another thing that he does, and this is thing about De Niro back in the 70s, was he was really big into method acting. He put himself through a lot of shit to really portray these roles. And so when you see a shot of him holding, when Travis is training himself and he wants to increase his endurance for pain, he puts his hand over the open flame on the stove. It's not just like a shot of some random hand. It's like a wide shot where you see De Niro actually standing there holding his hand in the
Yeah.
flame. But just to go back a little bit to the scene with the unnamed passenger, the character that Scorsese plays, he makes Travis stop and continue to run the meter, and he just starts rambling, going on, and he makes Travis look at the window of his house, and there's a silhouette of a woman, and the character is racist, and he's one of two characters in the film that really is explicitly racist. But and while Travis never makes any explicit statements of racism, it's another aspect of the film that
He's implied a little bit
there's a lot of. There's lingering shots on.
when he's going through the neighborhoods and stuff, or certain stairs. Did you notice that?
Yeah, like the camera lingers on African Americans to imply that it's Travis's gaze and that he's uncomfortable. And like there's a scene in one of the diners that the drivers are hanging out with, and there's a black cab driver that all the other white cab drivers seem really comfortable around, but you can tell that Travis isn't as comfortable around him. And the unnamed passenger is explicitly racist, because there's a black man that's having sex with his wife, and he refers to him with the N-word.
Yeah.
And he's really like this cab passenger is really sick, and he's the one that talks about having a 44 Magnum, and he's like, you should see what a 44 Magnum is going to do to a woman's pussy. It's pretty bad. And
Well, even Travis's eyes are like freaked out. Like he d doesn't he look
yeah.
kind of like terrified? Like, who's this fucker in my car?
I think he's terrified of what the guy's saying, but also terrified of like what it's awakening in him,
That's because that's when he flips.
yeah, and I think it's significant that as soon as he gets with the gun salesman, the first thing he asks is for a 44 Magnum, the gun that the unnamed passenger is talking about. And he ends up getting other guns besides that, because like
But he even tries to push drugs on him and he doesn't want it. He just wants
the
guns.
the salesman's like he lists like every he t they're closing the sale and they're pretty much done, but the salesman's like running off every drug he could think of, and he's like, "You want a Cadillac? I can get you a Cadillac." So yeah, he really starts training at this point. And one of the things that I've read that is kind of significant about the whole "you talking to me," he's like, "I'm the only one here, so you must be talking to me," is that like up until this point in the film, we haven't really seen him deal with much confrontation. It's like he's inventing it in his head. Like he's practicing what it'll be like if he's up face to face with somebody, and he's practicing this bravado, but it's just all in his room, and he's never actually had to deal with many. Like the only person that's really been like violent with him or has any kind of physical confrontation is Tom, Albert Brooks's character. And Albert Brooks is like set up as the opposite of him. He's
He's
not
real
threatening at all. Yeah.
conservative and non-threatening. He
Exactly.
doesn't even, he just wants the situation to be resolved. He doesn't want
Yeah.
violence at all.
And Travis sort of starts to like build up this picture of himself and in his mind that
But he hates that Albert Brooke's character, because
Yeah.
when they're eating pie, he's like, "Do you like that guy?" And she's like, "Yeah, he's all right. He's, a good person." And he's like, "I hate that guy. He treats you bad."
Right.
I don't
Yeah.
know. Yeah, and he never did treat her bad. I didn't
Right.
think so, at least what we saw. We kind of saw the same things that Travis saw, right?
Right. Yeah, so then there's the other character that like kind of gives voice to Travis's racism is the owner of a convenience store that gets robbed when Travis is in there. And
That's where he's like a vigilante.
it's a pretty brutal scene where there's a black man that's robbing the convenience store, and Travis comes up and shoots him from behind. You can kind of see him like working himself up to it, and it's the first time he's been on the streets with his guns. And it's
But
pretty brutal.
the guy did draw his gun, though. He did turn around.
Oh yeah. But it's pretty brutal afterwards when
The
that's
shop owner.
happened, and the shop owner comes around. He's like, "Did you get him? Did you get him?" And Travis is kind of freaked out. It's the first time he shot somebody, and he's like, "Man, I don't even have a license for this. I don't know what the hell I'm gonna do." Like, and the guy's like, "I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Get out of here. Get out of here." He's like, "You can just take the stuff you're holding. You don't have to pay me. Like, it's fine." And then
Because
the guy, like,
the guy's still alive at this point.
he's probably holding on to it. But then the guy, the shop owner, he just starts like he's like, "This is the fifth time, blah blah blah." He starts ranting, and he grabs like a crowbar or something. And he just starts beating the guy as Travis leaves. So it's another like real, it's like sort of a prelude to the end of the movie, the
Right.
shocking violence at the end of the film. But from this point, I feel like the end of the film, a lot of it has to circle around Lily. He makes an attempt to. Where he wants to, like you could tell his intentions are to assassinate Palantine, but because he had sort of scoped out the scene before, and made himself aware or made himself known to the Secret Service agents, they're able to spot him. This is the point of the film, like I see a lot of images with him with the Mohawk. This is
Yeah,
the point where he first shows up with the
but
Mohawk.
the part that's really that really keys him off, at least I think, is he goes up to the Secret Service guy and he goes, "What are you carrying?" He just starts
Right.
talking to him like, "Are you carrying a Magnum there? What are you carrying?" And then he starts asking like all these detailed questions.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Yeah, I'd like to be a Secret Service agent. How do I come become a Secret Service agent?" And they go into this conversation and the guy's smart enough. He goes, "Well, you know what? Let me get my pad out.
Yeah.
Let me write down your name, and can you give me your full address?" But Robert De Niro's smart. Like, he's very observant. He knows that he didn't want to give this guy his name. He says, "My name is Joe Blow," or whatever the name was, and he
Yeah.
gives him the incorrect address.
Right.
Even with too many numbers in the
It's like,
zip code.
that was six
That was
numbers. It's
six
like, oh,
numbers.
I was thinking of my phone number.
So that was a fascinating scene. And then he even like they try to tail him there, but he just runs off. And then this is the one part I wanted to discuss, but after I talked with a coworker, see, my coworker said, "You're going to really enjoy Taxi Driver. Let me know what you think of it." So we talked about it, and I started talking about the ending, which we won't talk about yet because that's later. But he's like, "That didn't happen. What are you talking about?" And he says, "I watched this on like TNT or whatever, and they didn't have that ending. It ended with the gunfight." And I was like, "Well, what are you talking about? No, I had an ending." So he went and told me about the Ronald Reagan thing. And my question to you prior to that Ronald Reagan thing was, I couldn't grasp why he wanted to go after that senator. I didn't understand it because it seemed like there was a little bit of a bond there. Like, why does he want to go after it? And then I read about the guy who was fascinated with Jodie Foster and went after Ronald Reagan to think he would, like, she'd come back to him or something. That was exactly what I think he was trying to do. Is he was trying to take him out of the picture So she might pay attention to him again.
Yeah, I think that might be part of it, and I mean, I think it is left open to interpretation, but I've also always kind of felt that as he is rejected, I mean, part of his reason in the senator, his interest in the senator is really just focused around Betsy.
But he's
You know,
not focused on the issues. He's not like
right, exactly.
looking at an issue and saying, God, I hate this guy. I ought to
Right,
take him out. It's totally around Betsy, yeah.
when he comes in to volunteer, she's asking him like, well, what do you think about his stand on this and stand on that? And he's like, well, you know, I actually don't really know what his stand is, but if you work for him, I'm sure it's a good one. And so, you know, when she's rejected him, I think that he also becomes disillusioned with the senator and what the senator stands for. And you don't get a lot of what the senator's policies are, but there's this whole like we are the people kind of thing. And I get the sense that he's really appealing to a middle class demographic. I mean, I don't think a lot of it has to do with the issues, but I think he's just like he fixates on the senator.
Just because of his association with
Betsy,
Betsy,
yeah.
yeah. It was just hard for me to grasp why he wanted, because when he gets that Mohawk, his whole plan is to go there and assassinate him. But the Secret Service agents from prior, they knew about him, except they like trip over their own feet. You know, they can't capture him. He gets away both times, essentially.
They spot him because of the way that he made himself suspicious in that other scene that you mentioned. Because he's unsuccessful, he switches over to his other fixation of Lily, and heads over to her part of town.
It was weird to see Harvey Keitel in a wife beater with pants up to his like almost to his like nipples. It seemed
Weird
like
style.
it was almost like a zoot suit kind of thing, you know. But it was very without the suit piece.
Right,
It was like
without the
without the
top.
top, yeah.
And he's got long hair, he's pretty built himself. He's a pretty he calls like he's his real name is Matthew, but Lily calls him Sport.
Yeah.
He goes, he approaches Lily, he wants to get her out of the situation. Significantly, before all this happens, he writes a letter to his parents, and it's clear that his parents don't know anything about what's really going on in his life. He tells them, I'd like to tell you more about where I'm at or what I'm doing about. I'd like to tell you more about my job, but he says the sensitive nature of my work for the government doesn't allow me to do so. I'm sure you can understand. And he tells his parents that, he's met someone and that her name is Betsy. He can't tell them too much more about that, but he's been going with her for a few months now. So he makes up this whole story about, and you can see what he kind of wishes his life was like by what he pretends it to be to his parents. And it's sort of his way of, at this point in the film, he plans on dying. So as you mentioned earlier, he to get time with Lily, he buys time with her, but through talking to her pimp, Sport, and he's real disgusted by the way that Sport talks about her, because Sport's selling her as a prostitute, so he's telling her all the things that she'll do, and he's just real disgusted by the way he's talking about her. And he gets some time alone with her. They go into, a hotel for the purpose, $10 for every 15 minutes or whatever kind of place. And it takes him a while to get Lily to to get out of her working mode, basically. I mean, she's just like, don't you want to make it? How do you want to make it? Like,
Yeah,
you know,
she's
I'll make
undressing
you
and he's
feel
like,
better.
put your clothes back on
Like,
and
don't do that. Don't do that,
yeah.
you know? And finally he gets her to believe that he's not interested in making it. And she says, and gets her to agree to have breakfast with them. So she tells him she gets up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And you know, they, and like you said, he finally gets rid of that $20. He sort of disgustingly throws it at the guy that runs the hotel. And I thought it's kind of significant that the guy tells him, you know, come back anytime, cowboy. They keep calling him, like the manager and sport, they keep calling him cowboy because he's walking around wearing
Boots, right?
cowboy boots. And he's actually got them on because he's concealing weapons in there.
Yeah.
But they just think he's a real weird guy because he is a weird guy. And at this point, he's particularly weird and he's acting very strange. And he has a lot of really weird interactions with Harvey Keitel where, you know, he doesn't get jokes and he doesn't take kindly to being teased. And at first they think he's a cop and a narc, you know, they're 'cause the way he acts kind of strange. But he comes down pretty hard on Lily at breakfast, you know. He's really critical of her and he's really harsh on her. And you can tell that the fact that she's 12 years old and she's doing the things that she's doing, I mean, it causes like a really deep anger in him. And just a lot of hatred towards sport. You know, he calls him the worst scum of the earth. He's the worst sucking scum I've ever seen. But you have an interesting scene where you see, you know, he's put a lot of ideas in her head, but she talks about, you know, oh, I'd love to move to Canada and go in one of these communes and stuff. And he offers to give her the money to do that, and he does end up leaving money for her, in an envelope. But we see a scene where Sport and Lily are alone, and you see the hold that this man has on her, the way that he's manipulating this child, you know, telling her he
He's
loves
kind of
her.
make yeah. He's kind of making her think she matters to him.
Right. Yeah, you
But
know.
I think that he she does matter to him, but just from a dollar perspective,
Yeah.
she's making him money.
Yeah. And I mean, this is like the whole film. I mean, it deals with a very ugly world, a really ugly reality, and there were a lot of ugly places in the 70s in New York, you know. You know, it's an ugly reality of being her, she being such a young prostitute. And I mean, Jodie Foster was an excellent actress from an early age. And I mean, it was kind of controversial, even her, you know, her casting, that they didn't have like a young looking adult actress play the part. And so the fact that she's 14 but a good actress, I mean, it really, like, there's no moment at which you're taken out of the ugly reality of her being so young, you know.
Yeah.
But
It is a really interesting gunfight when he goes in to take her, you know, to get her.
yeah, so that's the kind of like the culmination, like the
Yeah, the
climax of the film.
culmination, it's the climax of the film, and he pretty much takes out Harvey Keitel early on, but he doesn't really take him out for the kill. And then he goes up the stairs and doesn't he shoot that one guy in the ear? Or I
Yeah,
can't
he
remember
kind
what
of
happened.
like he. So he starts off. He goes because Sport. He hangs out as a
Yeah.
pimp will do. He doesn't deal with any money himself, and he hangs out like down the street in a doorway. And they're having another one of their like weird exchanges, and Sport tells him like, you know, like get out of here, get out of here. I don't want any trouble. Get away from here. And
Yeah.
then finally, like,
He
you know,
shoots him.
Travis really suddenly pulls out a gun, shoots him in the stomach.
And then
And
he
it's
goes
almost like
up,
he almost
yeah.
seems kind of aimless. Like he sits down on the steps down the street for a minute, and then he gets up and goes up into the hotel. It's like he's not completely like
yeah, he regroups.
Clear on
hey,
what
I
he's
just
doing.
shot somebody, and now I know it was like not a plan. It was like he was like going with the flow, right?
Yeah, you get the sense he's not totally like worked out what he's doing, and so he goes inside. He shoots the hotel owner that he talked to before.
And
but
that guy
because
just goes bullet. He only caused like a superficial wound because that guy's like all over him the whole time.
Yeah, the rest of the scene, he's just
all over him,
following
screaming
him
at him. Yeah,
screaming at him, and because he only shot Sport in the stomach, Sport shows up behind him with a gun and clips Travis in the neck. So the rest of the scene, Travis is trying to hold his neck because he's bleeding really badly from there.
Yeah,
A John had just gone in with Lily, and because of all the gunfire, he shows up in the door of the hotel room and shoots Travis in the arm. So now he's bleeding from two spots. But Travis kills him, and Travis goes into the room where Lily's at, and the hotel owner at this point is still crawling along behind him and screaming at him. And so Lily starts screaming and freaking out at all the violence, and Travis has used up the bullets, and there's a lot of shooting and a lot of like ineffectual shooting, as much as he's trained, and it's the hallways are dark, it's confusing.
So it's a very interesting way to film that.
Yeah,
the last scene's filmed with the color and the lighting, and it's filled very, very strategic, if you will. Or
yeah. I mean, and so he's used up his bullets, but he grabs the gun that the John had, and Lily's screaming at him not to do it, but he shoots the owner of the hotel point blank in the forehead against the wall, and then
he pretty much falls down though and looks like he's gonna die.
Yeah, I mean, he
like this is it, and two and then three cops come in essentially with guns pointed at him, and you think that's the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, he points, and before that he puts the gun under his chin.
Holy shit!
Trigger,
that's
like,
that's a crazy scene.
Three times, but
yeah.
the gun is empty, and so he would have killed himself. I mean, if he had any bullets left, he would have killed himself.
I'm so glad you remembered that because I didn't.
Yeah, but so then
and then he gets like his finger and puts
right.
it. He goes pew, pew.
Yeah, he's bleeding from his neck and from his arm, and he lies down on the couch, and when the cops walk into the room. He looks up at them and smiles and pretends to shoot himself in the head with his finger. So yeah, and then this really interesting ending where time freezes, and then from like an aerial view, the camera just slowly pans out because this has all just happened so fast and it's been so chaotic. And then the camera slowly pans out from the room all the way down through the path that he's taken through the hotel out to the street. So you see all the, in a slow motion action, you see all the carnage, it's all the blood and the bodies, and you get a chance to take in all this violence, which I think is really purposeful, you know, to see this, like, to be confronted with this destruction. And as
and
you
it
said...
it has an interesting twist.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, like, it's been televised where the movie ends here. And that's a really, 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 really significant change. And because the ending is really troubling, and the ending is really one of the things about the film that makes you think the most. And it's one of the things about the film that's been so debated. Because if the movie is to end here, well, you know, Travis is kind of, he's a bad guy, and he's created a lot of death, and he's most likely, you'd assume that he's got a bad end. But what happens is it jumps forward a couple months, and we see all these newspaper clippings where he has been hailed as a hero for taking out these these mafiosos and saving this 12-year-old girl from prostitution.
The
And
parents even write him a letter, like a thank you letter, like, we came to see you in the hospital. We can't afford to come back to see you, but you're a true hero. Thank you for bringing our daughter back to us. She's safe at home, blah, blah, blah. And he, so he's looked at as like a vigilante hero. Like he took out the bad guys. And then it could have ended there. But then it kept on going, and then there's a weird scene, like, where he's driving his cab again. You know, he comes out of his coma, he's driving his cab again, and Sybil Shepherd character Betsy gets into his cab, and they don't really talk until he gets her to her destination, and she says, "Yeah, I've read all of the articles about you," and he kind of just goes about his business, you know.
And it's filmed really weird because most of the time that she's in the cab, you only see her in the rear view mirror. And it makes you feel like for a little while there that maybe he's imagining it because you don't actually see her sitting in the
Well,
back of the cab.
that's what's surreal about the ending, though.
But then she gets out and
Yeah.
it's that whole thing is shattered. That idea is shattered because you clearly see her get out of the cab and talk to him from the street. And but it's things like that that and the way that the whole ending is done, that some people have suggested that this whole ending is a dream sequence, that this is Travis's end of the story. This is how when he's in a coma from what happened, this is how he's imagining his story ending. But I don't know, like
What does
some
Scorsese and them say? You know, I.
well, like Scorsese, as far as I know, hasn't really like sort of intended it to be talked about.
Questionable? Yeah.
Yeah, and
Leave it up for discussion, like the ending of Sopranos. Like the Sopranos ends and you're like, what the fuck? You're like, you have, there's things that happen in that diner that you're like, is something gonna happen? You know, it leaves a lot of questions, and this is what, maybe that's what he intended to do. But I agree with you now, because I thought, well, maybe it could be a dream sequence, but then why would they show us what they did? Like her leaving the cab, if it was for him talking to himself, like, and seeing her reflection in the rearview mirror, then that could be that way. But it could have ended in three places, and I actually let I don't know, I like the I guess the television version where it just ends like that. Because he could be a hero, but I don't know if all of that would have panned out with Jodie Foster anyway.
And I think, well, and I see, the thing I think is that I don't think that the ending is a dream sequence, because I feel like one of the things besides being a character study of like of a Vietnam vet, I think one of the things that the movie does, because it is a character study, because it's focused on De Niro, and like it's and you try to and it gets into his head, it's confronting you with like things that he says and thinks about the city, and it's not really providing answers, but it's making you think, like it's confronting you with his racism, like, and it's not endorsing that racism, but it's like confronting you with it and like making you think, oh, like if maybe you've had racist thoughts, like look, this is like the like are you really that different then just because you've had thoughts and you're not acting on them, like, and and so some of that is about perception of what's like an individual does. And I think you get sort of the sense like at the ending that even though like there's you could see it as a happy ending for Travis or like what he might be pleased with how things have gone, you don't really get the sense I think that he is better. Like I don't really think that he's cured or that something like this is not going to happen again. And then maybe next time, the media is not going to see it as a hero, him as a hero, and the way that things are twisted. Like we know because we've been so close to him for 2 hours that it's not so simple as him being a hero. Like, he's a dangerous person, and like, he doesn't have, like, yes, it's like getting a 12-year-old out of prostitution a good thing? Absolutely. But like, we also know that he has some serious issues with racism, and like, he also, the way that he just looks at people, like poor people and people like on the street, is just like,
Homeless, yeah, everybody. He just.
he just sees them overall as just like scum, you know, and he dehumanizes all these people. And like, he's a there's an issue there, and I don't
Yeah.
think the issue is resolved in him. And I think like,
It just turns out, like, if you look at it, that he did good things. Like,
right,
he could have killed that candidate. Do you know what I mean?
exactly.
It
And he
just so
wouldn't,
turns out he didn't.
and
He
there's no way.
could have hurt Albert Brooks. He could have killed him. He could
Right.
have hurt Sybil Shepherd. But he didn't. It just happens to be that everything that he did, he hurt the bad guy.
Yeah. And so we might look at it like, the media doesn't know that he was, before he went and rescued this prostitute, he was actually planning on assassinating a US senator. And if he had done that and never gone and been killed and never gone, like, he would have been a villain. And so I think that's one of the things the film is about. It's like, how easily things go one way or the other, and how like, the media representation of things and the presentation of things is not necessarily the truth, you know. And down the road, someone like this on the road, like, he's still working the same job and probably still has insomnia. And so he's still in these like really terrible parts of town all the time. Like, the next time he goes ballistic, you know, it might not be to save a prostitute, you know. So, you know, it's like, I think it keeps things from being it like it like, if you want to like end the movie in a comfortable way where you think things are black and white, well, like, the ending takes that away from you. And I think it's intentional to make you not feel settled by the film, and to make you keep thinking about these issues, and not think like, well, it's just simple, like, he's a bad guy, you know, or it's just simple, he's a good guy. It's like, he's not a good guy or a bad guy. He's a Vietnam vet that has a lot of issues and really needs help, and he's not getting it. And like, he has some good things about him, but he's got a lot of issues. Like, you know, he did a good thing getting a 12-year-old out of prostitution, but you know, like, there's a lot of things that he thinks that aren't too good, you know. So anyway, it's a lot to think about, but I find it interesting. And that's why, I mean, like, a lot of Scorsese's films, because I something I find interesting is like, men and violence, you know.
Well, it's a yeah, there's a lot to dissect in that movie.
That's why, like, Raging Bull is kind of like a companion piece, because De Niro plays a boxer, who is a huge womanizer, and like, there's and it deals with a lot of violence in a lot of other ways, and like, celebrity and fame. That I might even like even more than this film, just because it's like, De Niro's performance in that is ridiculous, and how good it is. But yeah, I'm glad that you, I thought that you would like it, so I kind of mentioned it a few times on the show before. And so I'm glad you found it interesting, and I think that you're like, the way that you just picked up on the whole veteran angle and stuff when the movie doesn't really like pound it home or anything, I think it's pretty insightful.
Yeah, it's a really, really good film. I saw two depressing movies this week. I actually really
Keith will be proud of you.
feel sorry for veterans that have that because they're there for our country, for peace for us. So I can sit and podcast and read comic books and do stuff. They're risking their lives pretty much for our country, and then they have to deal with this when they come back. And if you see American Sniper, especially the end, oh my God.
Yeah, I'd like to see that at some point, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's
Yeah,
definitely
it's.
like definitely still an issue that affects veterans today. It hasn't gone away for sure.
And I did find it weird. I like history a lot and stuff. I did find it weird that some of this did come from the Arthur Bremen diary.
Right.
I found that from an historical perspective weird. And then it has another historical perspective from the output. So you have like an historical incident that inspired the film, which created another historical incident because of the film.
Yeah.
If you look at it like that, that's like, it's insane. I
That's
mean,
pretty
it's just,
crazy.
yeah,
It's ironic that Jodie
it's like a
Foster is actually in the
circular
movie.
thing. Yeah, it is weird.
How, you know, he was, frankly, was obsessed with Jodie Foster, and she's actually in this movie.
Well, that's what he claims his insanity was, Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I think he got shot too. So it's like a circle. If you look at it from that perspective, like an historical perspective, it's a circle. It hasn't ended yet.
Yeah,
It's weird. A
it's kind of
circle of
crazy.
death revolved around this movie, except the senator that was shot, that caused the one diary, was paralyzed from the waist down. He didn't
Yeah.
pass. And
Yeah,
he
I mean,
was
and
he and that senator that was shot was extremely racist.
Oh, really?
Extremely racist. Yeah. So like, I mean, if you just there is so much this movie's so much more deeper and could cause like five other tangents, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a
That
lot to
you could
talk
do
about.
analysis on. Yeah, it's deep.
And I mean, I know you're not saying this, but like you know, I don't think that I feel like the movie analyzes, like, not encourages, you know, this kind of violence. And but that's the thing that a lot of people, you know, that they come to the film and they might look at it on a surface level, and all they think is like, oh, Travis is cool, like, I want to, you know, and they imitate the whole "you talking to me."
But everybody has their historical of who they are. Do you know what I mean? So the way you see a film isn't the same way I'm going to see a film. There's like a massive amount of people that will see the film kind of like the way we did, right?
Right.
But there's probably others that will see it at another level. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They won't look at it like. They could even see him as a hero. They could say, hey, this guy is a vigilante. He's a
Yeah.
punisher taking scum off the face of the earth. It's a very weird movie in that aspect because, and with all those endings, it just really throws a fork in the way you think about everything. It's a weird movie.
Yeah, and I guess that's the
It's
classic
deep and
thing.
it has some pretentiousness to it, especially like the ending scene, but I think it's all done for a reason. If you see the movie Fury, like Fury is a tank battle from World War II, but they use the same camera thing where they pan out from the tank. And you just start looking out, 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 and you see all the bodies around it, you know? And you kind of see that from this gunfight, you know? You start inside the room and you start going out, 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 all the way until you're out of the building, right? It's pretty cool shit.
Yeah, I think it well, it's just the classic thing of you know, somebody that would look at this film and just kind of see him as a hero and connect to the violence and stuff, like, that's inside of them already, and they're bringing it to the film, you know, like
Yeah.
comics. And it's not the film's fault, where, like, in comics have even, like, to transition comics have been subjected to the same thing in their history, where the comics are blamed for something that, like, the person reading them is bringing to the table themselves, you know.
Right.
And that's
So
the
yeah,
classic thing.
this was a really good movie. So far I've liked both our movie picks.
Yeah, I like them both too.
So we'll have to do this again sometime. I don't know if we're going back to the Buck Rogers to finish off that short season. Do you want to do that, or
Yeah,
do you want?
I'm ready to get back into Buck and to finish it up.
All right.
I think we should finish that out and then we'll go from there.
All righty.
I know listener Dave Levine is ready for us to get back to Buck.
Yeah.
He couldn't wait and he went ahead and watched the beginning of season two. So we got at least one listener that's ready for us to get back to the future.
Right.
So,
All right, so let's do you want to jump into some comics? We had one question.
okay.
It was from Shane. I'm trying to find it's going to be a because I've been posting like a mother about all the shit I've been reading. But
Yeah, and
his
I didn't happen to see
question came
that.
down. He's from Australia. He came down. It came down to who would be is Starsky or Hutch or the I'm drawing a blank because I don't know the professionals. Who would win, like versus? And I don't know who the professionals are.
Yeah, me neither.
So I would say Starsky and Hutch because I've even watched a couple of them because they show Starsky and Hutch reruns on the El Rey station.
Oh,
So
okay.
like I will watch some Starsky and Hutch. But I don't know what the professionals are. When I first read it, I was like, is he talking like Leon the Professional? Did you ever watch The Professional?
Yeah, that's the
See,
first thing that
that
came to my
movie's
mind
awesome,
initially.
and if that's the case, he's a professional assassin. Starsky and Hutch wouldn't stand a chance. But
Yeah.
I imagine that the professionals are a TV show. Guess I should see if I could look it
Something
up.
else, yeah. Well, maybe you can clarify the question or something, since we're clueless.
Yeah, it says TV show, so it comes up on Google. Yeah, I have no idea. It's a British crime television show, probably why I never watched it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it
But
sounds
it
interesting,
ran
but
from 1977 to 1983 in British TV, which means there were 57 episodes. If it was American TV, there'd be a lot more.
yeah.
It was the driving force behind the Avengers. The show was originally called the A Squad before they decided to call it the Professionals. So I guess it's like in the similar vein, criminal intelligence type TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah,
No,
I've
he.
never seen an episode, nor do I ever know if it was aired where I could see it.
He just
But
thinks we're.
it does say VHS and DVD Blu-ray releases in United Kingdom and Australia. He's from Australia, so yeah, I don't know anything about this TV show.
Yeah, maybe it's better known there.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just thinks we're better ver or better educated than we are.
Versed or more worldly.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I read a lot of good stuff.
Cool.
I'm
Let's go.
excited. Let's see, what should I start with? I'll jump into a reprint anthology, actually. It's DC Superstars number 2.
Ah.
Which this was, I think there was like 18 issues of this or something, and they were this is actually DC Superstars of Space. It came out, it was 50 cents, it came out in 1976, but there's three stories and they're all reprints. It has an Adam and Strange and Hawkman story that was originally published in 1964 in Mystery in Space issue 90. It has the first Atomic Knights story that was published in 1960 in Strange Adventures 117. And then the shortest story, the last one, is what's it called? It's the
Knights of
character.
the Galaxy.
Yeah, Knights of the Galaxy. It's Lyle. I had Lyle Space Commando written down, which is one of the characters, but that's from Mystery in Space number 7. So it's the oldest. It's from 1952. Actually, I mean, I like these stories. So the first one was by Gardner Fox, Carmine Infantino, and Murphy Anderson did all of the inks, and he also drew chapter 2. So because I mean because he did the inks in all three chapters, it really flows. It doesn't really look that much different than the ones that Carmine Infantino penciled. But I'll try to go through these stories quickly. And in chapter 1, we have Adam Strange and Alana on the planet Ran, and all of a sudden Earth appears in the same orbit of the planet Ran. And they go to Alana's father, who's a scientist, and they figure out that the Earth was transferred to their solar system with the same Zeta beams that Adam Strange uses to travel to between Ran and Earth. And at this point, Alana's father is able to, has, in his research, has been able to suspend Zeta beams, but he hasn't been able to figure out how to actually remove the Zeta beam energies from a body. And doesn't really have enough power to do so. Then we're introduced to the antagonist is a man named Orrin Dark. It's a very very Legion of Superheroes-esque name. So he's the bad guy. He's been studying Zeta beam technology, and he's the one that's been able to transfer the Earth there. And he's also then uses Zeta beam to transfer three objects from Earth: the Sphinx, the Roman Colosseum, and the Iwo Jima flag planting statue. They Alana and Adam, they find them in a just sitting there in this place called the Corallian Marshes on Ran. So there's a kind of a funny scene where, or terrifying maybe if you're a historian, where Oran uses the Zeta beam technology to pick up these monuments and start basically throwing them at Adam and Alina. And Adam just straight up fires with his blaster at the Sphinx's face. And then the Sphinx and the Colosseum are flying at each other, and Adam's trapped in between the two of them. He's able to escape because he flies through the holes in the Colosseum, the entryway and stuff. But the Sphinx and the Colosseum crash into each other, and there's a lot of damage caused. So again, we go to chapter 2, which is mostly focused on Hawkman and Hawkgirl. And this is the second Hawkman. This is the Kaitar Hole Hawkman, the one that's the Thanagarian policeman. So as we join them, Oran is using Zeta beams to lift Lake Superior right off the face of the Earth, and we just see like a crater left behind. And the Hawks, they have a spaceship. They get in. They follow to the short distance at this point to Ran, and they see that Oran has suspended Lake Superior over the city of Ranagar, and is using it to threaten the city. So the Hawks, they fire depth charges off of their spaceship into Lake Superior and cause an explosion. And the point of that is that it actually shoots out all the water and spreads it over a larger surface area. So instead of it just being dropped flat on the city and destroying the city, it just causes like a really intense downpour. And at that after this After this rescue, the Hawks meet up with Alana's father, and he fills them in on what's going on, and asks them to lend their support to the Ranagarian army that's mobilizing. And they are able to help out pretty significantly because Oran steals yet another significant geographical feature of the Earth in taking Mount Everest, and and elevating it over the Ranagarian army, and they would have pretty much destroyed by all of the debris, like the size of meteors that are falling off of the mountain. But the Hawks, they pull weapons off of their spaceship that they normally use to destroy meteoroids in space and fly around, and they must be pretty damn fast because they're able to take care of all these large falling rocks so that they don't smash the Ranagarian troops. So chapter three, of course, just kind of resolves the story. We see Alana gets to actually visit Earth for the very first time, despite the circumstances, and but they're not able to stay there very long. They get in their spaceship and head back to Ran, where they meet up with the Hawks. And Oran, this chapter is pretty much focused on Oran. He puts the Hawks and the Stranges in separate traps that they don't take too long to get out of. That aren't traps themselves aren't really all that interesting. And then because of the help of the Hawks, the doctor is able to Alana's father is able to use the Zeta Beam technology and to pull off of the radiation from the Earth, and so that it will, like Adam Strange does when the radiation wears off of him, it returns back to its rightful place. The day is saved, as they say. So it was a fun story. I think it's been reprinted a lot. It's kind of a famous Silver Age story. But also, I really dug the Atomic Knight story. This is by John Broome and creator of Kid Flash and Murphy Anderson. And Atomic Knights, they're.
Such a weird thing though, because they had like armor
I
that
know.
was like knights in a post-apocalyptic setting. Didn't they
Exactly.
used to write like Great Danes and I mean they
They
used to
might.
write dogs.
They don't have any mounts in
Oh, they
this
didn't mount
issue,
any in
but
there.
yeah, no mounting. No mounting in this comic,
And I
but
remember in the 80s and he appeared again, like just himself, as like a radioactive type armored hero in Wonder Woman. So
yeah.
yeah, he's had an interesting history.
Yeah, because I looked up some of that because I didn't really, except for just hearing about them in passing, aware of them as like a DC character. Never read any stories with them, and so yeah, I kind of looked up the history to see what else out there was. Especially when I read like older stories from the Silver Age or Bronze Age, and characters pop up that I'm not familiar with, I always jump on the database and see
Yeah.
what has been done with this character
So
like since then.
you're reading right now in the Bronze Age, but they're reprints from the Silver Age.
Exactly,
So it's a kind of an interesting setting.
But yeah, I mean this story is really cool. It takes place in 1986, which at the time was 26 years in the future. There's been a World War III, an atomic war, and we meet the main character Gardner Grail. He's being chased by a mob that's after him, and he's got some amnesia, but he's able to fill in some of the details of what's been going on because he finds a newspaper clip in his pocket that has a picture of him as a sergeant, and his memory ends up coming back to him over time. But he helps out this other guy who turns out to be a man named Douglas Harold, and he's a school teacher, and he saves him from this mob of humans that are after a can of food that he has. It turns out really nobody has any food because there's this dude named the Black Baron. And he's pretty much amassed all the food and the weapons in the area. And nobody has any food unless they work for him and do what he says. And so he's really kind of ruling this area tyrannically. Well, Doug and Gardner are attacked. And when they're attacked, they're near these suits of armor from like medieval times. And strangely, they're not affected by the radiation. And it turns out the suits absorb the radiation. And it's real wonky, like silly sci-fi explanation why that happens. And it doesn't really matter because the main thing is it's just cool to see people running around in medieval armor in post-apocalyptic setting. So they got these six suits of armor, so they take two of them and they look for volunteers to get inside the others. There's a guy named Brendan who's a scientist who volunteers, and then two brothers, Hollis and Wayne Hobbard. And they settle for five because the sixth suit turns out to be too small for a man to fit in. And anyways, well, interestingly, like right around the same time, Douglas Harold's sister Marlene is introduced, and she's a looker, and Gardner definitely takes interest in her. So the five men head out to attack the Baron's fortress. They are kind of using they use a tree to batter down the doors, and the Baron's baffled by and his men are baffled by the fact that their ray guns are having no effect on these men in the silly old armor. But the Baron does find an old rifle, or has an old rifle, and which does have an effect. And just as he's about to shoot Gardner, a mysterious small knight shows up to help. And the Baron's taken down. They distribute the food, and they walked in with five knights and they walked out with six. So, like, what the hell's going on? Well, as you've probably already figured out, it turns out that Marlene is in the sixth suit, and Gardner lifts up her helmet and kisses her. I thought it was a funny line. He says, "Someday I'd like to try that without the armor."
Well, I'm sure you would.
Yeah, it's like we already knew what you were thinking, buddy. But so they vow to protect the people, and ominously, Brendan the scientist points out that that there's going to be a limit to how long their armor is resistant to radiation. So they're not always going to have that protection, but they're going to do what they can while they can. And apparently they did have some continued adventures. There's a I'd like to read some more. I like these guys, and you can either it looks like you can either get a hardcover that just has all their adventures from Strange Adventures. It came out a few years ago, but just last year there's also a Showcase Presents that has this and a bunch of other kind of related stories. It has like the whole Hercules Unbound series from the 70s and a few other things to
Really?
fill up.
What is that called?
It is something featuring the Atomic Knights. Let me look it up. I think
Oh.
it's like the future featuring.
I just find it weird that they threw in like Hercules Unbound and all that other stuff.
Yeah, because it's well, yeah, it's. I mean, they had to throw in something if they're going to do a showcase volume, just
Because there's
because.
not enough material, yeah.
Yeah, I think there was like 12 stories or something. It's called Showcase Presents The Great Disaster featuring the Atomic Knights Volume 1, which I don't think there's going to be another volume. I don't know what they would put in it, but yeah, I mean, it has all the Atomic Knights stories from Strange Adventures. It has Hercules Unbound, which was a Jerry Conway written story from the 70s. It has a couple post Kirby issues of Commandy.
Ah, yeah.
It has a whole bunch of issues of Weird War Tales. Some of these, I think, are because the Atomic Knights appeared. There's like a issue of House of Mystery, a couple issues of House of Secrets, like The Unexpected. So it's all stuff that takes place in like a post-apocalyptic future, though, apparently. So that's a way of reading these, apparently. And yeah, finish up really quickly. Just the Lyle Space Commando story. It was the shortest, and it was kind of fun, but and it actually kind of was a similar theme to the last one in some ways. But the Space Commandos. There's Lyle, and they're recruiting new members. One of the daughters of the other space or Knights of the Galaxy shows up, wants to join, and they're really patronizing towards her. You know, like, you can't do this. Even though it's the future, apparently they're in the 25th century. The Galaxy Knights, their ideas about women are pretty akin to the 50s. And they're like, you can't join. Like, you know, you're a woman. You just need to take a vacation. So then a robot shows up and says it's from the planet Metallia and it wants to join the Galaxy Knights. And like, well, we never had a robot join, but I guess if you pass the tests. And the robot just excels at everything that they throw at it. And, you know, they tell it, like, you got to memorize these things to take the Retin test. And instead of just, like, finding the information in the library that he needs, he memorizes the entire library, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it turns out that that the robot was controlled by the woman the whole time. Aura, her name is O-R-A. So once again, these guys are put in their place, and or men in the future are put in their place into allowing a woman in their ranks. So, but yeah, overall, I mean, it was a cool anthology, and the stories fit together well.
Yeah, the cover looks pretty cool too.
Yeah, and I think this is a new cover actually. Ernie Chula, 1975 signature on it. So I think he put that together for the anthology. So
yeah, I think back then anthologies, they made a lot of money because they were truly just a reprint and they didn't repay the creative team.
Yeah, so they could just throw it out there.
All profit. Yeah,
make some more money.
Yeah, Brian Reigate just reviewed DC Special and talked about something very similar, different than DC Superstars. So there's a lot of reprint material out there.
Yeah, I have an issue of the issue he talked about was Green Lantern reprints, and I have an issue of DC Special too. I think it's a later one that's also Green Lantern reprints that I haven't read.
It's weird. When I was a kid, I didn't want any of the old stuff. No, I was like, this is old stuff. I want the new stuff.
I was kind of the same way as a kid.
But things have changed a lot. Like, yeah. I would stay away from, like, Marvel Tales because those were reprints of Amazing Spider-Man. You know, just things like that, Marvel Triple Action. These kind of books, they would only attract me if I knew they weren't a reprint. Or if I would look at it and it's sometimes say originally presented in Showcase 4. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, I don't want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. That was just the way I was when I was younger.
Yeah, I don't know why I was.
Keith Knudsen. This is a reprint. I don't want it. This is a second print. But I have a short issue to cover. I have only three comics to cover this time. This one I reread because of recent events in Exo Man of War. Current. And I don't know if you're current with it, so I'm not going to spoil it. So I'm going to throw out some things because this is old VH1. This isn't the new stuff. But there's some interesting things in here that that the creative team might have pulled out of this stuff, out of Armorines Zero. Armorines Zero originally came packaged with Exo Man of War 25. So that's also fairly interesting. I recently bought the gold edition, which is the one that has the gold border around it. I originally thought I had all the Valiant comics, and I know I don't have the gold ones. I never cared to get the gold variants. For one thing, they weren't a variant cover. They were just the same cover with gold. And I was like, so what? Why do I want that? other than it's rare and it's more of a collectible. You know, it's the same comic, same cover. But I wanted this one. I got it, ordered it. I am still missing some Turok. It surprised me. I found out that Turok had some comic magazines that were done by Acclaim, and I don't have them in my collection, so I'm trying to acquire them right now. But this came out in XO 25. It was originally packaged with it. I don't know what you had to do to get a gold comic back then. It might have been today you want a gold comic. Here's what you do. Usually go to the convention or have a friend go to the convention that doesn't want it. And they go to the Valiant table and they either wear like a Valiant shirt or you're dressed like a Valiant character, something to promote Valiant. They usually give you a gold comic. The other way to get one is to usually go to a convention and go to the panel and they'll say like, here's the code word, you can get a gold one. I don't know, like back in the day, how you got them. I don't remember if you send away for them or if they were given to retailers and then retailers decide who got them. But this is the gold edition. It came out in 1993. It was written by Jorge Gonzalez with pencils by Jim Calafiore. And at this time, Bob Layton was the editor in chief. And it opens up with a bunch of Marines. They're aged Marines though. They look like they're in their 40s, maybe early 50s, and they're going to a lab in New York, and it's like a very secret lab. They meet Colonel Gardner, and with them is Gunnery Sergeant Harold Lewis, Lance Corporal Antonio Cordova, and James Earl Williams. They look pretty old for their for being Marines. I guess one guy has a little, it looks young. There's a guy in a green shirt. He looks fairly young. But they go to meet a scientist called Zahn. Plays a big part in the new VH or the new Valiant universe. So, Harley, do you want to go out or not? She's got me trained like a Pavlov's dog or something. But
Pavlov's human.
the interesting thing about Zahn is Zahn here is a professor that seems like he's the scientist that create. He's an older man that creates the armorings. He creates the armors that these Marines are going to wear, and very different from the character that's in the current continuity. But there's some very interesting things in here about Zahn. One of them is that he's a weapons technology expert that had breakthroughs in the field of microelectronics. So that was a very interesting thing for me to read. But it also has a scene in there where these are Marines. It shows their abilities to do camouflage, their ion cannons, their enhanced strength, their ion. It has like a sword like Arok has now on his Exo Blade, where it'll just. It's like an energy sword that pops out of their glove and they can slice things. It's pretty much introducing the team and getting them ready for a mission to go after XO, which is very interesting because I want to read why they're going after XO, but there's a prologue or a epilogue or whatever you want to call it at the end of the story that has one of Arok's old secretaries, and I don't remember her, but it seems like she's got something out for Arok. So we'll see where that goes. But this was a pretty good issue. I really enjoyed it.
Cool.
Especially after reading the current stuff. This kind of gave, while it's not in continuity at all, it gave like an historical piece to support the current continuity.
Yeah, I mean, if there's something like a connection there that you want to mention, I don't mind some
No,
mild spoilers or
I
whatever.
don't want to because the if you're
Pretty
gonna read
current.
it's pretty current, like it just came out and it's people can listen to me on the Valiant podcast if they want to hear that.
That's true.
But yeah, I don't want to spoil it because there's some cool things with Zahn that is very interesting, and there's some things happening with the secretary in the current that series that's very interesting as well. So, what else
Cool.
you got?
All right, I guess I'll stick with DC. I read a couple more issues of Detective Comics. I mean, it's going back a little while, but last time we recorded, I talked about 580 and 581. Well, I did read 582. I'm not really going to talk about it. It was a tie-in, a Millennium tie-in, and I wasn't really that crazy about it. It was hard to make sense of without the other
582 of what again?
Detective Comics.
Okay. This one you
So,
don't want to talk about.
yeah, well, it's kind of like it's in the one it's the issue in between the ones I talked about last time and the ones I'm going to talk about now.
Okay.
And I mean, I did read it, but it's pretty much a Millennium tie-in, and it's really, really tied
Did it
in.
have to do with Gordon? Because he was, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it did have to do with Gordon
He was
and
one of the robots, right?
yeah, his past, and I don't know, it was that part of it was the okay part, but parts of it tied into other issues that came out that week, because you know how with Millennium they had each week had a bunch of issues, and yeah, it was just I wasn't crazy about it, but I was crazy about 583 and 584, which is the start of Wagner and Grant writing team with Norm Brayfogle art.
See, that's my Batman right
I'll say
there.
this is
Everybody
the
talks about
era.
their Batman, yeah.
I know
That's the era where I've always loved Batman, but that's when I was like vested, like I have to buy every issue of this series.
Yeah, and I haven't read these, but I've always found the covers, a lot of the covers, really attractive in this era. And I like reading DC in the 80s because the tone and like the storytelling approach is really similar to the Marvel comics I read when in the 80s that I really loved, but they're new to me, even though the style is similar for me. That's why I like my collection right now is a large portion of it is DC comics from the 80s. But anyways, yeah, so 583 and 584, it's a two-part story. Came out in 1988.
Could I interrupt you real quick?
Sure.
Who was the team on 582? Do you have that?
I can grab it
Okay. Well,
while I'm talking.
it's not a big
No,
deal.
it's I'll t I'll grab it while I'm talking. It's right I'm right near my comics. So 583 is called Fever, and it starts off, there's like a new drug on the streets called Fever, and one thing I made note of was it really made an impression on me. The first couple panels, it kind of sets the scene, and they really the team really gives you a feel of like the street, sleazy streets of Gotham. Like this is really like pre-Giuliani, like Times Square. Like you just see a lot of it's almost like Taxi Driver. Like you see a lot of strip joints and triple X movie theaters and stuff like that. It's real like 80s New York looking Gotham City. And there's this new drug on the streets, and there's these young kids that are taking it, and it makes you kind of gives you a short high, it makes you crazy. Well, this old man, he's a security guard, confronts these kids because they're messing about, and they already have a fire started, and sort of like this torch, and they end up setting the security guard on fire. So this is where Batman shows up, and he puts the fire out with his cape and wraps the old man up in his cape, but he's too late. The man passes away, but he takes out the kids because they're kids. He takes them out using painless pressure attacks with pressure points and stuff, and then Batman finds out from the police that that this drug is being dealt out of a fortified building, and the cops have tried to bust them twice because Batman's like he's kind of harsh on them, like what the if you know about this drug, why the hell haven't you done anything? And the cops tell him, you know, we have tried to bust them twice, but the building's so fortified, by the time we get in there, they've had plenty of time to flush all the drugs, and we can't catch them with anything. So then we get a scene with Scarface and the Ventriloquist. And the two of their henchmen, one of them's nickname is Fat Man, and I think the other one's name is Louie, something like that, just a normal guy name. They're in trouble because they've lost $50,000. And Louie, he flips out and gets sick of being talked down to and starts, you know, like, bitching out the Ventriloquist, like, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of working for a crazy guy, like, talking to me through a puppet. What the hell is this shit? And so that's not good. And Scarface opens fire and kills him. And Fat Man, he thinks he's been spared because Scarface sends him down to pick up drugs, the last two shipments of their drugs. It's not specified which drug, but have been stopped at customs. Back to Batman, he takes out a lookout on top of the building where they're dealing out the fever drug. It's you know, the kind that he's, this lookout, he spots people approaching the building and lets them know inside whether they're whether it's good to go or not. And so that allows Batman to get access through the entry that the lookout had used. And he stops the dealers. He surprises the dealers and stops them before they can flush the drugs. It's pretty funny. He, one of the guy, he's got an armful of drugs and he's running towards the toilet, and Batman pulls the rug out from under him, and such that the guy drops the drugs and lands head first into the toilet. And so Batman goes ahead and flushes it and gives the guy a swirly. I think it's the first time I've ever seen Batman give a criminal a swirly.
Put his head in a toilet, yeah.
And the issue ends with him getting the name of their supplier. And as you might have guessed, it is Scarface. And I'll, this issue also, if you check out the show notes, I'm sure it'll be in there. It has a really awesome Mike Mignola cover. Really cool. So issue 584 is called Fever Break. And it opens up with the Fat Man in Tijuana. And he's expecting to take maybe a kilo of fever back. And it turns out that they're expecting him to take 20 kilos. And he's like, you know, the last couple things have been stopped at the border. How the hell am I going to take 20 kilos back? Well, turns out Scarface wasn't so nice to him after all, because the man there in Tijuana strangles Fat Man. And they're planning on killing him all the time, all along. Fat Man's body is cut open and stuffed with the drugs. So, meanwhile, Batman, he confronts Ventriloquist in his club, and about the whole drug situation on the streets and stuff. And Batman's warning him. You know, Scarface is telling him his usual thing: "Don't talk to that guy. Talk to me. I'm the boss." Or, I guess he would say, "I'm the goss." And another kind of funny moment where, in response to that, Batman knocks Scarface's head clean off into the club. And what we see after that, though, is actually when he picks it up and drops it in Ventriloquist's soup bowl, he actually...
that's gotta be a great scene.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of, you know, Ventriloquist,
right?
He's so quiet and passive, and Scarface is like the aggressive one, you know.
Exactly.
He's like, here's the head of your puppet.
The Ventriloquist is freaking out about the whole thing, but Batman refuses to speak to the puppet, like, talk to me, not to him. I'm talking to you, Ventriloquist. Puck. And Scarface's head goes flying. And he's like, I'm going to be watching you,
Ventriloquist. Does Scarface say a word after the head is flying?
He says, ow. And he says...
He says, ah!
And he stops one of his henchmen from opening fire in their restaurant. And Batman goes and picks him up. He says, "Hey, put me down, Gat Green." And Batman carries him over. He's kind of like bouncing Scarface's head in his hand. So I'm going to be watching you, Ventriloquist, waiting sooner or later. You'll make a mistake. And then he drops Sploosh. He tosses Scarface's head over his shoulder. And then I'll have your head. And it lands in Sploosh into the Ventriloquist's soup. But what we see after that is when Batman gets back to his car, he's actually secreted a transmitter. When the reason he picked up the Ventriloquist or the Scarface's head is because he put a transmitter in it that he can use to follow them. So while he's monitoring them, Fat Man's body is sent back stuffed with drugs, and the authorities just think that they're bringing a corpse back that got knifed in Tijuana and killed, because Scarface has paid off the funeral parlor to let them know when they get the body and to let him in. So there's a scene where the ventriloquist is crying because, you know, he's like, "I've been together with Fat Man. We came up together. We've known each other for the longest time." And Scarface is yelling at him for being such a wimp. And he almost, ventriloquist almost pukes when they cut Fat Man open to get the drugs. So Batman's following their signal and he shows up and they fight. Scarface opens fire. He's going nuts. He's even hitting some of his men, killing some of his men in the process. And in the chaos, the fever, the bag of drugs is opened up and Batman gets dosed. So when he's about to take out the ventriloquist, it's like a Mortal Kombat. He's hearing this voice screaming, "Finish him! Finish him!" But Batman shakes it off and leaves before he goes through with killing the ventriloquist. Because Batman's really pissed about, not only is he dealing drugs, but he's dealing drugs to kids. So he shakes off the anger and leaves and calls the police in. And it's a funny little ending where Scarface and Ventriloquist are in jail together, like in the holding cell waiting to be transferred. And the Ventriloquist offers to turn state's evidence against Scarface, and Scarface attacks him, and they're like rolling around on the floor of the cell at the end of the issue. But I got your 582 creative team. The art was good. It actually does have Norm Brayfogle as penciler, but Joe Duffy is the writer.
Ah.
But, yeah, and so I sent you a link before the show that we'll put in the show notes. Just as you might already know, that Norm Brayfogle recently had a stroke, and they're raising money to pay for his treatment and stuff. So since I was talking about some comics that he drew, and he's, you know, Batman's one of the things he's known for, so I figured we'd put that in the show notes for people in case they want to contribute something to help him out.
I'll put him in there.
Sounds good.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. It looks like he's out of the hospital bed, at least sitting upright.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know like the full extent of the damage. But they're trying to get enough money to pay for all that bills, because just. If you consider one night over in the hospital, it's a fortune.
Oh yeah.
And if he's consistently there, it's ringing up a really big cost.
Definitely.
And when you're an artist like that, freelance, he was doing stuff for a DC, like mm-hmm. Batman Universe Beyond and stuff.
Yeah.
But he might not have health care. I think only the exclusives get that.
Yeah.
Try to contribute whatever you can, especially if you're a fan. Or you could even – I think they get like if you were to go buy a purchase for like an in-stock trades that he's done and stuff, I think they get some money from that
mm-hmm.
as him being a primary creator. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of his work collected. Like
Right.
this Batman run, which in my opinion is one of the best, is not really collected too much.
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. Are you leaving, Barb? All right, be careful. She's got to go to work.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Bye, Barb.
I have to work too, but I'm gonna work from home a little bit later. My next book is Unity Number Zero, so I'm sticking to Valiant. I have all those issues, but I'm starting to buy the trades, and trades were not too popular in '94, but Valiant did manage to put out trades for all of the early releases stuff, like Solar. I think there's a Magnus, there's a XO, but they never continued, just the very first ones. They did manage to collect the entire Unity volumes. The first one was packaged with a what do they call those? An encasing where you can include all the volumes. So you get the trade plus the
Oh, like a
book stand or the whatever that's called.
slipcase kind
Slip,
of.
thank you. I couldn't think of the word.
Yeah.
It's slip case. It comes with a slip case. And I had ordered it. The trades are pretty much inexpensive, which is good because if you want to read Unity, this is a good way to read it. The only thing that the trade is not good for is there's so much setup leading prior to Unity, especially like in Solar. It's kind of important that you read, like, if you want a full picture, that you start with Solar and work your way to Unity, because it does give you some stuff, but it doesn't give you a lot. So this is written by Jim Shooter, and Barry Windsor Smith is the penciler. The inker is Bob Layton, and the colorist is Janet Jackson, and I'm pretty sure it's not Michael's sister.
Control.
So the story opens up with Erica Pierce, and there's an event, Horizon Black Hole Singularity, which happened in Solar, and she's flushed into that black hole, and then all of a sudden she's falling out of the sky in Chicago in 1991. She falls out of the sky naked and lands on in a used car parking lot. And destroys the car where the owner comes out. What'd you do to my truck? And he's like, wow, come to Papa. She's all sexy. He's like, you're naked. Well, Erica Pierce is naked and she doesn't take well to that. She uses her abilities to, I don't know if she killed the guy. Yeah, she did kill the guy. She basically shot energy and she's like, how did I do that? Like, she doesn't even know she has the energy power right now. She basically lit him on fire and he's a burning carcass. And she's like, what world am I in? Very strange. Like, she doesn't know what's going on. Meanwhile, in Oklahoma, you see Solar looking at the body of another instance of Erica Pierce. And she's dead. And he's with Jeff, the geomancer. And he's basically telling the backstory of Erica Pierce and how they have to go after her. And that she could be hiding in a world, between worlds, if you will, like another continuum. And he takes Jeff to that continuum. And in this world, here's where it gets interesting, because in this world, there's dinosaurs, but the dinosaurs are not organic. You'd think if you had the license to Solar and Magnus at the time of Unity, you would have thrown Turok in, you know, because of he's a dinosaur hunter, Turok.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And these dinosaurs are not creatures, they're mechanical beings. So they get there and they see all these creatures there, and they also see a lot of buildings, like sci-fi buildings, in this lost world. And he's basically saying they have to take down Erica Pierce. And he's like, there's no way that we can take down Erica Pierce with just us. You have to go back and get help. He says, I'm going to rip off my hand. It's got enough energy for you to create a portal, go back to our Earth, and get Eternal Warrior, get any help that you can possibly get. So he basically takes his hand off and gives it to Jeff, and he goes back to Earth to try to recruit some help. And he manages to call the Eternal Warrior and say, "I need your help." And he's like, "I'm busy right now." But then he also uses the hand to port over Exo and the Harbinger kids. So he's basically recruiting them. And then he also realizes he can port over Galad, the Eternal Warrior, ports him over. And Galad is like, "Do you realize what you just took me out of? The life and death situation? You just brought me here." And he goes, "Well, if we don't solve this problem, there won't be an Earth." So he also gets Archer and Armstrong, and Archer, I mean Armstrong is Galad's brother. So they all go to the Lost World themselves. Meanwhile, Solar has managed to get future Eternal Warrior and Magnus and Rai from the future to also help in this Unity event. And they show Erica Pierce, and she always wears this like sexy this costume might have come out of Logan's Run, because it's that green see-through costume that what's her name wears. That's the runner with Logan.
Yeah,
It's like a
Jenny's character, Jenny Adductor's character.
her character. Erica Pierce wears something like that. It's like a see-through garment. She has a son, which will get interesting in future issues. And they're getting in defense mode basically, because they know that Solar has arrived with an army of and there's an army of heroes, and she sends a bunch of robotic warriors after them on pterodactyls. So that's how Unity number 0 ends. And it says to be continued in Eternal Warrior number 1.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is this, I didn't catch if you said if this is the first time that you've read this or.
No, this is like the third time.
Okay, I thought you'd read it before.
Yeah, this is the first time I've read it in trade format.
And probably refreshes your memory and probably interesting to read this stuff in light of reading like
Current
current,
Valiant.
yeah.
Yeah, it's very
To see how they're
interesting.
using stuff.
It feels a lot like, I don't know if you're reading The Valiant,
I haven't yet, no.
but it feels a lot like that event feels a lot like this event, because it's like a gathering of heroes to fight the immortal enemy. So in this it was a gathering of heroes to fight Erica Pierce. So yeah, it was a good issue. And man, Barry Windsor Smith is the shit. He could draw like really awesome.
Nice.
It's a distinctive style that you would know immediately once you learn his art style.
Yeah. And it's cool that he did work for Valiant.
Yeah.
So now you can go back and look at that, and it's cool that he was a part of their history. So. All right. Well, my last thing is some more Tomb of Dracula. I've talked about the first three issues of this 70s Marvel comic on previous episodes of the show, and I read a bunch this time. I read actually 4 through 7, so I'll go through them in less detail. Issue 4, like the first three, was written by Archie Goodwin, and the art continues to be by Gene Colan. Really good. I mean, I really like his art, and it's definitely suited to this series. So when I talked about in issue 3 in the last episode, and that ended where a woman named Ilsa Strangeway was wanting to be turned by Dracula because she wants to regain her youth. She's a really beautiful woman, and she's gotten older. And she's manipulated things so that she'd be confronted with Dracula. So this continues right on from there, and Dracula warns her that there are worse things than aging, but she persists. He asks what's in it for him, and she presents him with a she's, you know, over the years collected all this occult items. She's pursued this goal in her life, and she's got this mirror, which is dark, has no current reflection, but apparently if she gives him the incantation, it will allow him to travel through time. And she tells him, you know, you're just recently back to the 20th century, and you don't know yet how out of place you are here. You're going to want to return to the era that you're originally from before you were staked by Van Helsing. So he ends up agreeing to this, and he turns her. So then Frank, our heroes Frank, Rachel Van Helsing, and her servant Taj, they are still on Dracula's tail, and they end up speaking with Ilsa Strangeway's servant, because Ilsa's servant, he's been with her for a long time, and he is starting to recognize that his mistress has basically gone off the deep end. And when Dracula turns her, he protests, and Dracula puts him in the hospital. So they go and talk to him in the hospital when they get word of it, what's going on, and he tells them what's going on. So they head out to Strangeway Mansion, and they find footprints that lead away from the mansion that, why wouldn't have Dracula just turned to a bat? But they surmise that he was probably carrying her. And we then see Dracula and Ilsa wake up in a cave nearby, and she immediately tries to attack Cliff, the guy who was friends with Frank and got turned into Dracula's, like, Renfield character. He's still with him. But Dracula tells her, you know, keep your hands off of what is mine. I will find someone for you to feed on. And Frank and Taj, they go after Dracula while Rachel waits there in the cave for Ilsa to return from feeding. And they kind of hook up this, like, technology where they have flashlights with a cross image on the flashlight so that it projects a cross. And this is kind of an example, shown as an example of the type of technology that Dracula is not expecting.
And then it works.
Yeah, apparently that works, the projected image of the cross. And
you don't have to have faith for it to work.
Right. This is no, like, Silent Slot or Fright Night or anything. This is pretty, like, more traditional mythology of vampires. So, so they get Dracula on the run, basically,
seems like a cheap, effective weapon.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you could just always have flashlights. Like, as long as you had batteries, you'd be okay.
Exactly. So this is kind of driving home for Dracula that, yeah, maybe there was something to what Ilsa said. I don't know what these, because he's never seen a flashlight, doesn't know what it is, and he does feel a little outnumbered. So he takes off for the mirror because they've got him on the run. He doesn't know where else to go, and he jumps through. And Taj actually ends up following him. He's in the midst of trying to prevent him from going into the mirror and gets pulled through himself. And we know at this point that Ilsa, the deal between Ilsa and Dracula, both of them weren't really telling the full truth. Well, Ilsa is tricked because she let herself believe that as soon as she fed, that she would be restored to her youth. Well, the truth is that vampires, when they're turned, they stay their current age that they were turned at, and they continue to age and look older the longer they are away from blood. And when they feed, it returns them to the age that they were at when they got turned. So she's stuck at the age that she was already at. She has, that's not what she wanted. She wanted to be returned to her youth. So she actually lets Rachel Van Helsing shoot her with the crossbow in the heart, but not before she reveals that she also tricked Dracula, and that the mirror, unless somebody opens the portal in a mirror on the other side in the time period that they want to go to, you just end up in this sort of like limbo where there's these terrible creatures. So for issue 5, there's a change from the writer to Gardner Fox. He writes issues 5 and 6. Same art team. So we see Dracula and Taj in this limbo area, and Dracula saves Taj for food because he doesn't know if he's gonna. There are any other humans there, and even though he's fed recently, he wants to make sure he's got something for later. But he's able actually to end up finding. He finds another mirror in this limbo area, and it takes him to the past. Luckily enough for him. And it takes him to his original time period. It takes him to a point at which it was not long after he was staked by Abraham Van Helsing. So people think that the terror is over, but it's still really fresh in their minds. And he goes looking for Abraham. But it turns out that he's in Abraham's away from his home. He's in Bucharest for a little while. So Dracula feeds on a townswoman, and as soon as her body's found, the town freaks out, you know, that the terror is still continuing, that Dracula is still around. But Frank and Rachel, meanwhile, they're able to get the incantation that Dracula used with the help of Ilsa's butler, who's still in the hospital, and they follow and are able to rescue Taj, who's still sort of stashed away in a coffin in the past. And so it's an interesting kind of development here where we get a new character introduced, where Dracula, he returns to his castle in the past, and he's got a female vampire that he's trapped in this glass vial in blood format, and he sets her loose because he wants her to be a distraction to the heroes. They knows they're after him at this point, but she fails, and the heroes are able to stop Dracula from killing Van Helsing. Dracula and Lenore, the female vampire, they escape back through the mirror into the present. So issue 6 takes place back in the 20th century, where this is a real interesting story where Dracula and Lenore, they both feed, and it takes place like on these moors in England, where there's this shaggy monster that's terrorizing the moors, and there's the moors, the land, they're owned by this aristocratic family called the Derlings, and when the bodies of the people that the vampires have fed on are found, the Derlings are noticeably concerned, but then they almost seem relieved when they find out that our heroes think that they were killed by vampires. And they feel like this is a strange reaction. Well, it turns out that this monster that haunts the moors is actually the Derling's son, Randolph, and that the Derling family, they have this curse where every few centuries a child is born that has these diseases. Like, I don't know if these are real things or not, but they call them rachitis and nevus pilosis. And like, one's responsible for deformity, and the other one is responsible for hair growing, like profuse hair growing all over the person's body. So he ends up looking kind of like an abominable snowman or like a Bigfoot kind of.
I think that's like a freak show thing. Like, it really is a disorder.
Yeah, I thought it probably was. It sounded pretty official.
I think so. I'd have to Google it. With my new wireless, I don't have to be next to a computer, which is nice. I could sit on the couch.
There you go. Chill. Kick back. So yeah, so it so Dracula leads them all into a trap at this castle because he knows where there's an oublette, where there's this deep pit and it's got a cover on it which only Dracula has the strength to lift. Not even Taj is strong enough to lift it, and he knocks Rachel and Frank down in there, and seals the oublette. And so it creates this, like, one of those classic moments where they think they're going to die, and so Rachel and Frank confess that they love each other. But then Randolph, the monster, who is, it's like, you know, the Frankenstein situation where he looks terrifying, but he actually has, like, a good heart. He has the strength, and he shows up, and he lifts the cover and gets them out. And so finally, with issue 7, Marv Wolfman becomes the writer, and he remains the writer. And this is one of the things that he's known for at Marvel at this time. Same art team, though. This takes place in London, where a woman named Edith is attacked by Dracula. And Dracula is surprised that she recognizes him. She's not surprised by the sight of a vampire, and she's ready with a crucifix. So, by that point, Dracula takes off, but she still needs help because Dracula, with his power over rats, has drawn a lot of them, and she's surrounded by all these rats. Well, an older man in a wheelchair shows up with a dog that he calls Saint, and the two of them rescue Edith from the rats. So then Rachel Van Helsing, she gets a telegram, and it turns out that it's from this older man. And he turns out to be, this is a new connection back to, just like Rachel Van Helsing, a new connection back to the Bram Stoker Dracula, where this old man, he's Quincy Harker, and he's the son of two protagonists from the story, Jonathan and Mina Harker. So he's their son, and so Edith is their is their granddaughter, just like Rachel is the granddaughter of Abraham Van Helsing. And Quincy, he's a cool guy. He's like, he's in a wheelchair, but he's really into technology. So he's like, him and his daughter, they're vampire hunters as well. And he's developed all this, like, these technological innovations to fight vampires. So Dracula, he figures, puts two and two together. And so some support, he actually hypnotizes a bunch of children, and then he goes and attacks the group of vampire hunters and leads them back to his fortress, where they're kind of suspicious at this point, as they realize that he's been making it really easy for them to follow him. But they go up to his coffin, and there's a fake body in the coffin, and the children come out to attack. So the heroes are put in a situation where they're fighting enemies that they don't want to actually harm, but they're able to actually break the spell, and the story kind of resolves itself pretty quickly at that point. But the main thing I liked about it really was just how Wolfman immediately pulls in some more descendants of the characters from the Bram Stoker story. And I'm still, like, really, really loving this comic. I like just the horror and just how the characters, a lot of, like, characterization, and the Gene Colan art is just really, really nice to look at.
Yeah. Someday I need to visit that because I haven't read too much Dracula.
Yeah.
I have all three omnibuses. 1, 2, and the 3, which is the magazines. So,
it's good stuff. I'm liking it.
So and my
that finishes up for me. That's all for me.
My last book is a book that Bill Zanowitz of the Comic Book Bears turned me on to because he posted on 11 O'Clock Comics Facebook page, and I ran across it, and I don't read a lot of Facebook, but I scan stuff for, like, Kirby, and I saw Kirby, and I'm like, oh, what's this? And it was like a Phantom Force from Image Comics, And I was like, I didn't know Kirby did this. And I looked at it because he asked the question, is this one of Kirby's last works, you know, published? And what's really fascinating about these Phantom Force covers is they're all inked by the founding fathers of Image. So, like, they're inked by Jim Lee, Eric Larson, McFarlane, and Rob Liefeld. So this cover here is a Jack Kirby cover for Phantom Force number one. It only ran two issues at Image and then went to Genesis Comics, so or Genesis West. I don't know why that happened, and I didn't look it up. But so the creative team on this is the plot and pencils are Jack Kirby. The script is Jack Kirby and Mike Thibodeau and Richard French. Michael Thibodeau finishes the series after about issue 4 or 5, and there's no Kirby involvement. But and then it goes to like 8, and there's an issue 0. So this series takes off with what I think is the Phantom Force and a bunch of weird, obscure characters. Apocalypse is one of them. He's like a fully costumed hero that's invading this facility, searching for a vial or a canister, and he's got another helper called Probe, and then there's an assistant that they have that actually drives a vehicle. His name is Bobby. So it centers around them trying to get a steal a vial from like a medical facility and fighting a bunch of armed guards. The main plot is there's this weird group of characters. One of us is called Sensei, and the other one is called, I probably won't be able to find his name now. Da, 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 da. Yeah, I'll if I find, run across it. Oh, it's Tatsuki. They're accusing our current government of creating viruses and releasing them on areas within the United States that they want to get rid of people. And they also have an antidote, and that's where Apocalypse or and his team Probe went to stop it. And they tried to steal the antidote, but they weren't successful. They actually got in a fight with these like androids, and they had to escape. And then the scene cuts to this new fighting ring where there's a fighter called Jinsing, and he's fighting this huge sumo guy, and he manages to defeat him with like kung fu. He's pretty badass. And Sensei tells the other guy about this character, Jinsing, and he says we need to recruit him in order to get that vial. And if you look at like Jinsing, he's kind of like a master of kung fu. He kind of looks like him drawn by Kirby. In one page, it even has like Jinsing, master of the martial arts. And he has a cool scene here with like Jack's Newsboy Legion, even though they're not the Newsboy Legion. There's several characters that they introduce that is like an offshoot of the Newsboy Legion. I don't know if like Jack had like a bunch of buddies when he was real young that he used to hang out with, and that was like his inspiration for doing the Newsboy Legion. But he's really good at writing stuff like that, like kids that are part of a club that are very different. And they're just in awe because he's a popular guy, Jinsing, and he's a good fighter. And they have one of those guys. All these characters I could kind of like map to the Newsboy Legion. You know, I could take almost every one of the ones that are shown and say, hey, that's that. That's Gabby. That's.
They clearly wanted to use them but couldn't, so
Yeah, that's Flippa Dippa. You know what I mean? So that was interesting itself. But his girlfriend breaks up the huddle and says, "Oh, you were gonna show us some moves on fighting moves," and he doesn't show him because he's going on a date with his woman. And there's a mysterious van that's following him, and they throw a gas pellet and capture both him and his girlfriend, and they're pretty much blackmailing him into working for them in order to get the vial, or they'll hurt his girlfriend. And it's the good guys that are supposedly blackmailing him. Sensei trained him, and he basically says, "Yeah, we're all being blackmailed by this guy. We don't have much of a choice." Tatsuki seems like he's a good guy, but he's using blackmail to bring the good guys together, and he doesn't seem like he's like the taxi driver, I guess. You could look at him as a good guy, or you could look at him as a bad guy. And he's gonna help the resistance, and there's some great pinups of Jen Sing with Jack Kirby and Eric Larson, and then there's another one with one of the characters who I don't know yet, and that one's by Jack Kirby and Jim Lee, but I didn't read the back matter, but there's a lot of people talking about it, like Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee, Jim Valentino, Eric Larson, Mike Thibodeau, Jerry Ordway, a lot of big creators, so. It's a
That's
very cool
cool.
comic. I'm glad I
I like.
found it. Thanks to Bill for pointing that out to me. 'Cause immediately when he showed it, I was like, I must own this, and
Yeah.
went to eBay and bought the full run.
Nice. I like when they had that. Even if you don't read it right away, it's cool when they have the extra back matter in there for you to check out. It's like extra value.
Yeah.
Stuff.
So it's a I would recommend it if you're a Kirby fan to even if the covers alone are historical to have Kirby inked by all these guys, that's to me that's worth the cost of admission right there is just to have these pinups and these covers.
Yeah, that's cool.
And this one is clearly Kirby-esque. Like you could look at the artwork and say, going back to DC's, Fourth World stuff, it looks like that. So
Yeah.
if you like that, you'd like this.
Yeah, I mean those guys all really revered him, and it was cool how he sort of connected with the independent scene that didn't really exist in the prime of his career. And I think if he lived at a different time, he would have been much more involved in doing independent comics and stuff instead of going back and forth between DC and Marvel. He might have just been like, screw this, like I'm doing creator-owned
I'm
books for
gonna do
Image.
my own stuff, and this is
Yeah.
what it'll be. But
He had that
it
option.
was so late in his career.
Right. It just wasn't an option while he was alive, or I mean, until the very end. And,
Yeah.
but I think he would have done a lot more of it if he lived today.
Yeah. And this the other thing that's amazing about this series is it's pretty much dirt cheap. You can find these things for cover price. And well worth it, especially if you're a Kirby lover.
Yeah.
And even if you're a fan of some of the creators I mentioned, like McFarlane, if you want to be a completist, you need this. That's good stuff. Well, that's all we had. I guess
It. We're back.
next episode we'll be back to Buck Rogers season 2. I think it's a shorter season than season 1.
Yeah, it
I
definitely is.
think it's like three quarters or half as long as the first season. I
Yeah.
don't think it was very successful, and I think we're in for a treat. I think it's going to be very, very different from what we're used to.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm interested to see what it's
Yeah.
like. Be interesting.
All
So
right.
yeah, so next time. And who knows what comics we'll talk about because we
Yeah,
don't
who
know
knows?
ourselves.
Yeah, we don't know. I don't usually know until the weekend of.
Yeah.
I just know that you'll probably hear some more Valiant at some point and probably some more Phantom Force. So you can reach us at Geek Brunch Podcast. This was episode 47, I think.
Yeah, it might be, yeah, that, sorry, that might be right.
So this is episode 47. You can reach us at emails at mythmakingetc@gmail.com, right? You didn't change that, right?
No, I did
Okay.
not. I think most of my contact info for this show
Yeah.
is the
If you see him on Facebook, you might like, who's that?
same.
But
Just like to keep it a mystery. I'm actually the Bill Bomer of Earth 2. So, and all this other is just camouflage.
Yeah. And mine is Mike at comicbooknoise.com. We have a Facebook page at Geek Brunch Podcast. You can click the like button and follow all the episode threads. Plus, get in on the interesting discussions that some of our listeners start based on the episodes. And then we have our regular pages, geekbrunchpodcast.com. And Twitter's at Mike Myers Brunch and at MythMakingETC, or is that different?
Nope, it was different briefly, but I changed it
Yeah,
back.
that's why I freaked out. Is like, where's it at MythMakingETC? It was weird though, is when you did change it, I would type at MythMakingETC and it would bring up your new stuff. At
Yeah.
least my laptop did. So.
Honestly, like, I mean, just briefly, like, a lot of that was going on in the early part of December when Luna was sick, and it just kind of put me in a weird headspace, and yeah, I was just kind of restless in general,
Yeah.
and yeah, it's all good.
So that's it, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll talk to you.
I'll get this out soon, and then I saw that you're looking to go to Heroes Con, so I'll keep you updated on that. I
Yeah, I
think
think.
I'm going for sure. I'm not so sure that Barb is going.
Okay.
Barb is either going to go to Heroes or Baltimore, and I don't know which one yet.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to go to both, but unless something really, really crazy happens, I'll definitely be going
I hope you can
one or the
make it
other.
to one. Yeah, just one.
Yeah, almost definitely, unless like something really crazy happens.
Yeah.
I'm pretty determined to make it this year, because I mean I think our listeners probably know this, but if not, we haven't met. We're almost to 50 episodes, but we haven't
Yeah.
met in person. So
I've met every other person I podcast with.
yeah.
Yeah, Campbell, Daryl, Keith, and Bomer. Bill goes to conventions too, but not as frequently,
Right.
unfortunately.
Yeah.
We always have a safe elevator when he's there, though.
If he doesn't make it, I'll just take the stairs. All
All right, well, have a good one, Chris.
right,
I'll
you
talk
too.
to you later. Bye.
Yep, bye.
Step in his way. He'll keep low numbers rolling. This may be.